Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
Welcome to Publishing Rodeo. So this week we are doing an episode on predatory presses or vanity publishers, whichever your preferred term is. And this is a topic we've not actually gone into very much because I kind of assumed wrongly, I think, that a lot of the people listening would be, you know, if you're on submission, if you have an agent, that's not necessarily an interesting topic to people who are past that stage of querying. But we do actually get contact from quite a few writers who are still at the querying point or who've had experiences with these kinds of presses in the past. And I think it might be a good idea to talk about these publishers and how people can keep themselves safe. So we have with us today, just a very quick aside, I'm really sorry, I've got a lisp. I've just had braces put in like 2 days ago. Anyway, we have with us James D. MacDonald, who I first encountered on the Absolute Right forums. And if you've ever heard the phrase, money flows to the author, I believe James is the person who's credited with actually coming up with that phrase and popularizing it. And I have learned so much indirectly through his posts. I don't think he ever, in his writings and his activities, about vanity presses and how to stay safe. So if you'd feel up to it, would you like to introduce yourself and tell people how you are and how you came to be involved in fighting predatory publishers?
Hi, I'm Jim MacDonald, and I'm a writer. I've been published since 88 with my wife. We wrote together. We have upwards of 30 novels and a whole lot of short stories published for money, because you can't take awards or the adulation of the millions to the grocery store. How I became interested in the demimonde of scam publishing. There I was in beautiful downtown Colebrook, New Hampshire, where I live. And we've got a weekly newspaper, which publishes things like the results of the Cub Scout Pinewood Derby and the week's menu at the high school, things like that. They have to do something to keep the ads, you know, hitting each other. So when Local Man publishes book, which I've been doing regularly for a lot of years at that point, hey, that made front page news. I got home and here's the phone ringing, and my name is in the phone book. I'm not hard to find. Here's a guy calling from Groveton, New Hampshire, which is about 20, 25 miles down the road, a decaying mill town, which is in the process of having its last mill shut down. And he wanted to know how much it had cost me to publish my book. And I said, no, you don't understand. I don't pay publishers. Publishers pay me. And we got to talking, and it turned out that he had sold his first book to what was called Sovereign Publishing up in Canada. And Sovereign had explained to him that because publishing, especially first books, is so difficult, such a chancy thing, that publishers and authors split the cost of publishing. So he had mortgaged his house to pay his half of the publishing fee. Mortgaging your house in a decaying mill town. Oh man, we're talking about somebody who is literally betting the farm on his writing. I'd never heard of Sovereign Publishing, even though they claim to be Canada's fastest growing publisher. And I suppose that's true. If they published one book last year, two books this year, that's 100% growth. That's, you know, pretty decent. I got interested in this. And I looked around. I was doing school visits where you go to the schools and you talk to the kids about the happy, carefree life of the freelance writer and things like that. And I was noticing flyers from Sovereign Publishing tacked up in the teachers' rooms. Do you have a book? And I said, wait a minute, because publishers generally don't go looking for authors. Authors go looking for publishers. this just did not smell right. The publisher of Sovereign Publishing, I'm not making this up, was a guy named Don Fellon, which should have been a clue. And he was collecting the money from the authors, and the money that they were paying was sufficient to pay to publish a book. I mean, they were paying a lot. But he was not using all that money to publish a book. He was using it to print two copies, some Jiffy print. And those get sent back to the author. Those were the author's copies. And there would be zero other copies out there. Don, he needed to get more and more people sending him checks. So he started to write letters to marginal agents out there. And there are a lot of marginal agents saying, do you have people submitting books to you that you don't want to represent? Send them to me and I will send you a finder's fee based on what they give me. It's nothing, it's not a kickback, it's a finder's fee, perfectly legal. So he was getting more people. Then he said, wait a minute, why am I paying money to all these Goombas out there? Wouldn't it be better for me to just to create a literary agency myself and have people send their manuscripts to me and I would sell the book to my own publisher? It was great. And then he said, well, if one agency is good, two would be better. So he had them like names like Anthony A. Aardvark Literary Agency, you know, all began with the letter A, so they were at the top of whatever list, and people would send them to him. Eventually, authors started to call their agent on the phone and say, hey, what's the matter here? Haven't seen my royalties. You know, what's up? And the agent would say, well, don't know a thing about it. And so the author would then call the publisher and not notice that the same voice answered the phone at both numbers. But eventually, authors did start to put things together. This was back in the early days of the web, when people were starting to talk to each other. And eventually, somebody entered a legal action against Don, and because they were Canadians too, they could do that with that. Because getting into international law is just a real bear. You don't want to do that. So Don decided to screw this, and he did the midnight flit. He was gone. He was banished, leaving behind all the stuff in the office that he had rented. So the landlord said, well, you know, since Don left, everything here belongs to me, including all the manuscripts. So the landlord of the building took all of these unpublished manuscripts and sold them to yet another marginal press up there in Canada. Then wrote to all the authors, because their authors' names and addresses were right on the first page of the manuscript, and said, we have possession of your manuscript. Unless you pay for its return, we will publish it ourselves and keep all the money. This is actually not right. But a whole bunch of authors did pay to get their books out of hock because the rights situation was difficult at this point. And that's what became of Don Fellon. At about the same time, we had a guy by the name of Bill Apfel, if I recall correctly, out in Buffalo, New York, had this similar kind of scheme, which was he was set up as a book doctor. This is called Edit Inc. What Bill did, because he was... his day job was a swimming pool salesman in Buffalo, New York. And I don't know if you guys know what Buffalo is like, but it's pretty friggin' cold there. He had a lot of time to stand and not a lot of sales. But he even got a column called Ask the Book Doctor in Writer's Digest. People would send them his manuscript, and he would have the manuscript edited and sent back. And people paid him a lot of money for this. What they didn't know was that Bill had hired a bunch of high school students to do the actual editing. You know, people in the honors English class, they edit it. Whether they were good editors or not, I don't know. Bill then decided to do the same thing that that Don Fellon had done with the agencies. He said, why am I paying these finder's fees to all these Goombas out there when I could just set up agencies myself and have everybody send their stuff to me? So he set up, you know, the 123 Literary Agency and the Abercrombie and Apple Literary Agency and all these things. That was Bill Apple, and his partner was Denise Stearns, and they did pretty well until the state of New York noticed that this was going on, and there was wire fraud, and there were tax problems and all this stuff. Eventually, this is one of the rare cases where it actually went to court, went to trial, and Bill Apple was required to repay $5 million in restitution to the authors, which will give you an idea of how much money he brought in if he had to pay back $5 million. Unfortunately, he'd already spent it. So I don't know if anybody got their money, but that was Eliot Spitzer when he was Attorney General of the state of New York who did that before he had some ethical problems of his own. I don't know if you recall what happened to poor Eliot Spitzer. That's aside from literary. That has nothing to do with literary things.
We're not from that area and probably not that era. Yeah.
About that same time, there was a guy down in Frederick, Maryland, Wilhelm Meiners, who was from Holland, and he had a partner named Larry Klopfer, another partner named Miranda, whatever Miranda's last name was, not important. She was the literary brains because she'd been an English grad student before she ran into problems down the Southwest somewhere. And Bill Meiners, he was with an out-and-out vanity press. You send us the money and we will publish your book. He had used Bill Apfel's Edit Inc. as his editing arm because, you know, every author knows that your book has to be edited, right? What they don't know is that with a legitimate publisher, the publisher pays the editor. The editor is on the publisher's staff. And you, the author, do not pay diddly. And certainly you're not paying for a high school student to go over it with a red pencil, even though that student might be really pretty good. But Bill Meiners, in his vanity press, and that was called Erica House, named after his wife, Erica, he noticed something very interesting, which was that a vanity press author could sell 75 copies of his book. Or if he was a real go-getter, maybe 120, 130 copies. That's, you know, sell them to mom and dad, your best friend from high school, the guys in dad's carpool. You take it down to the church hall after church and you sell it, you know, while people are sitting around eating coffee and drinking donuts or whatever it is you do in church reception halls. And you're going to want to have a couple of cases of books in your basement just in case somebody wants to buy one, and a case of books in the trunk of your car. I mean, you just want those, don't you? So he said, everybody, no matter how bad the book, if the half the pages are blank and the rest are printed upside down, can sell 75 copies. So he came up with a brilliant plan, which was he would not charge anything. He would charge nothing. He would accept pretty much anything. If he did the cheapest possible job of production and the cheapest possible printing, thanks to print on demand, you throw a manuscript file into a Docutech machine, an IBM Docutech, and it spits out a paperback book at the far end. It's great. And if he raised the cover price high enough to a level that only your family and friends are going to pay, because he figured only family and friends are going to buy it anyway, so what the hell, he could make a profit on those 75 copies. Now, if somebody sold only 60, that's okay, because somebody else would sell 80. It's all working the average. The same way a casino works. You know, somebody might make $1 million at a casino, but that's because 10,000 other people lost 10,000. This was Publish America, PA, otherwise known as Publish Anything.
You know, I think so, Jim, just to give you a little background, because I sure don't expect you to have listened to all of our episodes or
anything,
but we have, I haven't listened to them all either. We have something, you know, like 40 or 50 hours at this point of basically talking through mostly traditional publishing and the positives and negatives. And what we're hoping to do really with this episode is correct what may be a misperception of, a misperception on the part of some people who have heard us criticizing trad publishing and take that as an endorsement of vanity presses like PA, like all these others that you've mentioned. But one thing that I find interesting as you're going through that last example of Publish America is that my complaints with traditional publishing, and I may get into a little bit of trouble here, with respect to people, they sign on small deals and then do not do a very good job of publishing, mirrors that experience very closely, right? except that they have distribution networks set up and they can throw a larger number of books onto shelves just by virtue of being the publishers that they are and having the relationships that they do. And they don't have to really worry too much about it because they'll probably make money on any book they publish, even if it doesn't sell very many copies, because they don't tell us this, but it's very obvious that they spend a whole lot more on the production process on some books versus others. That said, traditional publishing does have a lot of legitimate positives, even for people who haven't received the lead title treatment. Whereas nearly universally, I like to hedge, but this is a case where it's probably safe to say universally, vanity presses and even, I guess, hybrid. I don't even know what you define as hybrid, but vanity presses are universally not a good idea. And we as a show do not endorse anybody ever paying money to have your book published, particularly in the case that this publisher does not then have set plans and capabilities to do something with that book. Now, when you get into indie publishing, right, when you're indie publishing, you're likely going to pay somebody for editing services. You're likely going to pay for production of your physical copies, maybe even design of your digital copies, etc. And that's a little bit different thing, though maybe not too different. But yeah, long story short, Publishing Rodeo does not love vanity presses.
I actually have learned something from the stories you're telling just now about the agency stuff, because, you know, I've spent a lot of time in like Facebook writing groups talking to people about trad publishing. And there used to be like a couple of them, but one woman in particular in one of these Facebook groups who claimed to be an agent, and she was always coming out to shell for vanity publishers like Pegasus was one. She was always going, oh no, they have legitimate contracts. I was thinking, what is this person who sends their authors to Pegasus? But actually, I mean, it's probably what you're saying. She's either on the take from them or she is them with like a fake account or something. Yeah. Anyway, I have that lady blocked now because she drove me insane. But I think the most amount I've ever heard someone spending is about 25 grand on trying to get their book published. But even it feels like even kind of upwards of 10 grand is not that unusual these days. And
No, it is not at all.
It's a staggering amount of money. But one of the things that these publishers tend to say is like they now, you know, as awareness of vanity presses have grown, and I guess I tend to call them predatory presses because vanity gets people's backs up and it doesn't really matter, right? Predatory, they kind of wear different faces, say they're legit or hybrid, or a lot of them will say we are selective and we do review our submissions. And I think that this is something you actually tested with the Atlanta Nights project, if you want to talk about that a bit.
Atlanta Nights, yeah. Eventually, Wilhelm kind of pissed me off. I'd been quite vocal a number of places. And so he wrote this, he created a web page somewhere called Authors Market, or I think that was what it was called, where he said, you know, science fiction writers don't know what they're talking about. They are inept practitioners of an undemanding art. So if they tell you that something's a scam, or they tell you how to get published, don't believe them. Unlike Publish America, which carefully vets all of its manuscripts, only picks the top ones and all this. So I decided to see if I could create a manuscript set with realistic characters in today's world, which Publish America would buy, even though it was dreadful. Dreadful, dreadful, dreadful. It was really bad. And I got together a whole bunch of other science fiction writers, and over a long weekend, we wrote Atlanta Nights. Everybody got a list of characters with a one-line description. Every single female, in addition to, you know, what they were and what their relationships were, was described as beautiful and bosomy, while all of the men were described as incredibly well set up. And the authors could decide what that meant. And a very, very sketchy plot outline summary. In this chapter, Callie Archer goes bra shopping. In this chapter, Bruce Lucent goes to jail, and so on. They were authors were told this is a sex and shopping novel set in Atlanta, Georgia, in the present day, written by an enthusiastic but unskilled first-time writer. And, you know, longtime pros can produce really bad prose. I mean, Eddie Van Halen can make a guitar sound like shit if he wants to. Hey, we can write badly. We really can. And then I put these together in the order received, not in the order of the chapters that of this overarching plot. And if a author failed to produce their chapter, there was just a blank there. There's no chapter. In one of the chapters, I used a computer program to create text based seated on the three chapters before it and the three chapters after it, and it's a mess. Anybody who wants to, by the way, can find the full text online, or there are a couple places on YouTube where people have read the entire thing out loud. It's wonderful. Also, the names of the main characters, if you take the initials of the main characters' names, it spells out Publish America is a vanity press. We sent this thing off to Publish America. A while later, we got this wonderful letter saying this was going to change our lives, that our book had been accepted. Oh, joy. Hot damn, we said. We have been vindicated. We are not inept practitioners of a undemanding art. We can create real life situations with realistic people and realistic dialogue. At the Aresia Convention in Boston in the spring, in late winter, and the very next day, that we announced it on the Sunday, and Monday morning, here's Publish America writing back saying, after further review, your book does not meet our high standards. Big surprise there. So then took and published it for free. And you can, we published it at lulu.com, which is a straight up, you put in the manuscript, they run it through DocuTech, you set your own price, there you go. And I set the cover price so that the royalties per copy came back to the exact same as the royalties per copy of a Publish America book, only our published on the DocuTech book had half of the cover price of a Publish America book. And it's still out there, and buy one, better still buy a dozen. They make excellent gifts. If you go over to TV Tropes, they have a really good summary of Publish America, Atlanta Nights. And we had a good time with it. We were running. I mean, it's the best bad book you could write in 3 days.
I just want to read this review of it by Teresa Nielsen Hayden, yeah. who's she's a advisory editor at Tor. She says the world is full of bad books written by amateurs, but why settle for the merely regrettable? Atlanta Nights is a bad book written by experts. So there you go.
Yeah. Oh, we got legitimate reviews. So I think it was the LA Times that wrote in their review. I mean, that's a serious major newspaper. They wrote in their review, the muse struck like a stomach flu and up came Atlanta Nights. Publish America eventually collapsed. Hey, what can I say? Because it was based on sand. It was Publish America that invented the term traditional publishing. Up until then, publishing was publishing. He called himself, I'm in publishing. That's what I do. But they invented traditional publishing. They were doing print on demand through Lightning Source, which was a company that owned a whole pile of DocuTechs. And you send in the manuscript and they spit out however many copies you need. It's an expensive process on a book by book basis, but if you're only publishing 10 or 20 books, you know, it's cost effective enough. Legitimate publishers use DocuTech machines to put out advanced reading copies, for example, where you don't need a whole lot of copies, but you need them tomorrow.
And just to very quickly interject, there is actually a whole thing that you'll find with the term trade publishing and traditional publishing, and I think we've touched on it briefly before, but this is a good point to very briefly mention that writers of a certain generation, of which I would count myself a part of, we were raised to say trade publishing, because that is a specific term that means a specific thing. Like if you go on the penguin.com website, it, you know, it says in the about us section, we are one of the world's leading trade book publishers. That is because it means that they produce trade paperbacks or hardbacks from mass market distribution, whereas traditional publishing, you know, as Jim says, it was really a term that was invented by vanity presses to legitimize themselves, and they can use it because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't promise that they have distribution. It doesn't promise they produce mass market novels. It doesn't promise that they go through any of the channels or work in any of the ways that a publisher you would expect them to function. It's kind of like the difference between the word counselor and doctor, right? Or psychiatrist, I guess. At least in the UK, you know, you can set yourself up as counselor. I could do it tomorrow. I could start charging. I could start taking clients, and I could do that without having any kind of like qualification because it's not a protected term. Whereas I can't go tomorrow and call myself a psychiatrist or a doctor because those are protected terms and they mean something. It's why sometimes when you see hybrid presses or vanity presses that call themselves traditional publishers, that's why they can do it. Even though they don't offer any of the functionality or the distribution or the actual printing and mass market production of books that you would expect, because it just, like, it doesn't mean anything as a term, and it's also not really true. I mean, traditional, technically speaking, self-publishing is the original traditional form of publishing. That's how people made books back in the day. And it's really a relatively recent thing in kind of the history of publishing that we had a publisher who will take on the costs and the financial risks to produce the books for you and distribute them. It used to be, if you wanted to get a book out there in the world, you probably had to be some kind of aristocrat or businessman with your own funds and access to a printer and all that kind of thing. So just for lots of reasons, I still kind of hate the word traditional publishing, even though that is what we use now in modern parlance. But I do think that the origins of the word matter. But anyway, I'm getting massively off topic. Really sorry about that. So back to Publish America, and I'll let you carry on from here, Jim.
That was Publish America, and there were others. There was Lee Shore. What was his name down in Tom Green County, Texas? What he did was he accepted manuscripts. He claimed to be a editor or an agent. He would open up the envelope enough to see if there was a check in it. And then he would send back to the author, here's what you do now. Here is a copy of my letter saying that you have an agent, because everybody knows that publishers want to deal only with agented authors. So you put this letter saying that you have an agent right at the top of your manuscript. You're golden. You're an agented author. And here's a list of publishers to send your book to. And he then cashed the check. And as far as I know, never even read the manuscript. It was great. Eventually, the sheriff of Tom Green County, a guy by the name of Johnny Walker, said, wait a minute. And he eventually wound up in prison for a while. And he changed his online ad, and all these people had an online presence, saying that he now lived in an exclusive gated community, which is why he could not receive phone calls and could only get letters on Fridays. He got probation, and part of his terms of his probation were that he never again engaged in literary things. But his office manager, a young lady named Leanne Murphy, knew the whole deal, and so she set up the Desert Rose Agency with the same scam, same exact thing. You got what's his name? Robert M. Fletcher down in Boca Raton, Florida. As far as I know, he's still in business. Bouncing Bobby Fletcher. He has down to a science. You enter through a portal on his webpage, and he's got a lot of webpages under a lot of names. The New York Literary Agency, the Bestseller Literary Agency, the Poets Literary Agency, this and that literary agency. And so you send him your manuscript. 12, 14 hours later, he has an autoresponder set up that says, your manuscript looks interesting, but first you must have it professionally evaluated. Go with any professional evaluator that you wish, provided we approve them. We have got a special deal with a New York professional manuscript evaluator. And if you get 3 green lights from them, we will represent your book. And the professional manuscript evaluator was Bouncin' Bobby under a different email address. And he had a special deal for normally getting your manuscript professionally evaluated would cost you $180. But if you went with his professional evaluator, it cost only $90. He would now have a list of people who were willing to pay $90. And they all got three green light approvals. How's that work? And so he had this whole set of autoresponders. He did not have to do anything. Said, you know, we will represent your book. And then he would, we will submit it to your book to three New York publishers for merely $30 each. And he would do this around and around as many times as it took, and with people paying $30 a manuscript, $30 a submission. And the publishers, and I knew a good number of them, had never received the manuscript from him. And he would come back and say, well, here's your response. You got not right for us at this time. The market is crowded at this time. And so he say, well, I've got another list of three more publishers who want to see a book like yours. And this would go around and around and around until they got tired of paying money. But then it got better. He said, well, why don't I create a publisher? After they've gone around and around and around enough times, I've extracted all the $30 fees I can. Happy day. Oh, look at, oh, joy, oh, joy. This publisher, Strategic Publishing, wants your book and will only cost you $2,000 to be published. Wow. Oh, joy, oh, joy, oh, rapture. He, too, had a contract with Lightning Source so that if he needed to publish, if he needed to print books, he could. But he's still in business. Even though the state of Florida eventually came down on him for wire fraud. And he has clipped his wings quite a bit. But you can find these news stories. I read one not too long ago. A 6-year-old boy in England had sold a 23-book series. Whoa! Soon to be a bestseller. And so I looked at this and said, holy crap. He sold it to Strategic, didn't he? Yes. So... I guess Mummy had some money.
Yeah, so if for newer authors, because I feel like vanity publishers are changing so much all the time in the ways that they operate, and you know, these kind of horror stories about fake shady agents and stuff. What advice would you give to authors currently who are querying, trying to keep themselves safe, trying to keep their work safe?
Oh my goodness. A publisher that you want to talk with is one that has actual physical copies on the shelves of actual physical bookstores that you've seen with your own eyes, because they have distribution. Amateurs talk plot, pros talk distribution. So you go to a bookstore and you find books that are similar to yours, and you then submit it to those publishers because they have got actual distribution. And okay, you're going to get 10% of the cover price of, or 15% of the cover price of the book, and rather than your lower tier publishers that are offering you 50% of the cover, or 50% of the net, or 75% of the profit, or whatever they're offering, because 10% of 100,000 is a hell of a lot more than 75% of 100. It really is. And so you get their guidelines and you follow their guidelines to the letter. And pretty much every one of them is going to say agented manuscripts only. And you do not go to Desert Rose, where they will give you a letter that you can Xerox and put with a package saying that, yes, you do have an agent. Instead, you find people, you find that agent's guidelines, and you follow them to the letter. And part of that is to test to see, are you the sort of person who can follow directions? Are you going to be hard to work with? Because nobody wants to work with somebody who's going to be a pain in the butt. It's just because life is too short. Their desks are covered 3 feet deep in other manuscripts. Are you that much of a genius that you can overcome being a jerk? And while you're waiting to hear, because this is a long process, I've seen glaciers. I've seen rocks grow from little bitty pebbles to great big boulders and die in less time than this process takes. while this is going on, you write a new, different, better book. The first book that you write is probably not going to sell anyway, because the first book that you write probably sucks. Because, you know, the first time an Olympic championship figure skater goes out on the ice on skates, they probably fall down, don't they? It takes a while to learn how to do this, even if you are a natural storyteller. And you send it out and you take it to the best markets you can, because the higher end markets get better distribution. Our first adult novel was called The Price of the Stars. It was sold to Tor, which is part of the Macmillan family. Anyway, Tor. And
we're
it was
Tor.
It did not come out as a front look.
We're both Say with again. Tor.
Yeah. We're both Tor authors.
Are you? Go you. So it came out not as a front list, not as a back list, and not as a mid list book. It came out as an off list special. And we were blessed by the fact we had a really great cover art. It was beautiful cover painting. And it went out to bookstores, and they had printed 5,000 copies. And those 5,000 copies sold inside of the first week. And the bookstores wow. were calling back and saying, "Hey, who are these guys?" They were people who were, well, first of all, were just great authors. And the other part was, we had a great cover. And it was in every friggin' Walmart, Walden Books and Barnes & Noble, what may have you, from coast to coast, because Tor had great distribution. And that book eventually went to at least 7 printings. And it is still available in an electronic version. Buy one, better still buy a dozen. They make excellent gifts. And been getting royalties on that twice a year since when I think 90. I'll take it. What more can I begin to tell you about that?
No, that's fine. I was going to ask a very quick controversial question, actually, which is, what is your stance on
sure.
hybrid presses?
The answer
presses?
Is 4. Hybrid presses. What's that even mean?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, if you're talking pure self-publication, you remember Yag's Law, money flows to the author. Good. When you're self-publishing, you are the publisher and you are the author. Unless you can see your way clear to taking 15% of the cover price of every copy sold and put it into a bank account somewhere labeled author's royalties or mad money or fund or whatever. Unless you can see that, you have no business publishing. You as the author, you're just collecting money. You as the publisher, you're paying for the editor, you're paying for the cover art, you're paying for the reviews, you're paying for the distribution, you're paying for everything. And it might take quite a while for you to make your money back. You may never make your money back. That's the thing. Legitimate publishers, big publishers, they have got a whole stack of money that they can use to support new experimental first-time authors who probably will not sell a whole lot of copies. Although I promise you they will sell a lot more than 75 or 150 if you really hustle. And no, you don't need to sell them out of the back of your car. Just remember that money flows to the author, even if it's going from one pocket to another pocket in the same pair of pants. 15% of the cover price of every copy sold goes to you, the author, and the publisher doesn't get to take that, doesn't get to keep it. And if the book doesn't earn out, that's on them. And that's on you as the publisher, not you as the author.
Yeah, I
just
think
remember
my big,
that, guys. Yep,
my big depressed. Thing with hybrid is always just that, like, they don't really tend to have the distribution. So I always question, like, are you actually getting more out of them than you would self-publishing? And occasionally the answer is yes. I think the iconic example is probably J.R.R. Tolkien, who went with essentially a predatory press and just got very lucky. But most people don't have that experience. Before we wrap up, could I ask you if you want to plug yourself, if people want to, I know you still have books that you're selling these days, and if you still have like a website or a place to find you online.
Any of the online bookstores, any of the real doors and windows bookstores. The most recently published one was a reprint of our book, Knights Weird, K-N-I-G-H-T, apostrophe S, Weird, W-Y-R-D. It's an old word meaning fate or fortune. our joke title when we were writing that was Night's Weird, Lady's Strange Too. But it was on the New York Public Library Books for the Teenage list. It won the Mythopoeic Society's Aslan Award for Young Adult Literature. Buy one, better still buy a dozen. They make excellent gifts. And they've been it's been reprinted by Tor's Essentials line, the science fiction and fantasy books that everybody should be familiar with. And I really enjoy that. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah.
Plus, you know, all of our short stories, well, not all of them, but a great number of them are in electronic form in all the usual places. And I sell them mostly for 99 cents because they don't let me set the price any lower. I'd sell them for a quarter if it came down to that. Because what's a reprint, you know? It's, you're paying me to take my advertising. Go you. Go me. It's great. Now, you asked me what hill I will die on.
Yes, I did. We do often have that. Go for it.
Okay. I am going to put two spaces after every full stop, after every period. Space, space. You take my double space when you pry it from my cold, dead typewriter.
Do you still use a typewriter?
Actually, I use word processors because it's really easy to retype with them. You know, with a typewriter, in order to get a clean copy, oh man, that just took a while and a lot of whiteout. But with a computer, you know, you can do that. It's great. But I've ripped out all of the bells and whistles. I've made it as close to a typewriter as it'll get and still be on a keyboard, on a typewriter, on a computer. I learned how to type on a Remington portable that my mom had back in the 1930s. It had a key press like a Charles Atlas hand exerciser. I knew back when I was 10 that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. I knew that writers had to type. So I taught myself to type using a book and record combination for the White Plains Public Library. And so I did all the exercises. And every time I made a typo, I would get down and do 10 push-ups to remind myself not to screw up.
Wow.
Well, that's pretty much it. I'm a fast and
accurate
typist.
That's a lot of push-ups.
And oftentimes, I will do push-ups, yeah. It's great.
You've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.